Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Person has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore.
Oh! Stop! Oh!
Brother. Leave Toledo, Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me as always is Rich Craich. Rich, great to be with you.
Yes, great to be back.
And we are going to start a little series on the top game sevens of all time. And we're going to start off with the early rounds, the first two rounds of the series. The first round's really only been seven games since 2003, so there isn't quite as much going out there. And of course, the way that playoffs have expanded over the years, it just kind of made sense to combine these two into one unit. But we will do the conference finals and eventually the finals in a few weeks here. So, but this is fun. This has been kind of some interesting stuff to research.
Yeah, the research has been a lot of fun. It's allowed me to watch a lot more kind of videos and highlights of these different games and stuff. And some I remember, some I don't. Some I remembered some stuff about, and then some I didn't remember anything. It's been pretty cool, though, just to kind of go through and watch them. And the research has been fun, too, seeing a little bit of, you know, how these teams got this way. You know, what happened afterwards? What happened in that game? Because, you know, we tend to focus on this, you know, podcast. We focus a lot on, like, a big career and big overall sense. It's kind of fun to sometimes focus on just one game and really look at everything that goes into that one game and the individual performances of that game, too. Because, yeah, so often we're looking at, you know, 10 years of history, 20 years of history, that sort of stuff. I mean, it's fun to just kind of really focus and kind of hone in on one particular game. So
yeah, and there's some fun what if scenarios that kind of go on. There's some fun you know, just sort of marking like, oh, okay, this is kind of how, you know, this run of this team ended or began, or, you know, or this is okay, if this had just happened here, maybe this would have happened, you know, that kind of thing. I think we'll get into some of that with the seven games that we picked. But
yeah,
I want to go through some of the honorable mentions. You know, we looked at a lot of games. We kind of, you know, looked at all the game sevens, just kind of narrowed down based on the games that obviously were close, had a short scoring margin. Also, we talked about historical importance, great individual performances, notable moments, and, you know, we also included some variety to spice it up because we didn't really want every series to, you know, involve the Celtics and the Lakers, although plenty of them still do because...
it's really hard. It's really, really, really hard, especially like an NBA Finals thing. It's like, man, there's just so much of those two teams in big spots and then in a lot of clutch, like, game sevens, too. So it's really, really hard to figure out to not have, you know, half the things be Celtics Lakers, but I think we did an okay job.
Yeah, I believe so. I think the listeners will enjoy it. So some of the honorable mentions, the Lakers and Bulls of 73. This was sort of the last hurrah of the Wilt and West Lakers. They went to the finals but lost to the Knicks that year. And then in 79, in the Eastern Conference, the Spurs and the 76ers, yes, the Spurs were in the Eastern Conference for a few years, a duel between George Gervin, who had 33 points, and Julius Erving with 34. The 76ers won that, excuse me, the Spurs actually won that series, but then lost to Washington in the conference finals. The Sonics and Bucks of 1980, Gus Williams had 33 points, an extremely close series throughout. This was the last year for the Bucks in the West. It was also the last year kind of marking the end of the line for the Sonics as contenders. After the season, Dennis Johnson was traded and Gus Williams held out for a season. So interesting to kind of think of them as, you know, if they'd have kind of stuck out longer, how, you know, they would have, the Lakers would have had to deal with them in the early 80s. And the Bucks too, you know, if the Bucks hadn't moved out west, it would be interesting to see, you know, how their ceiling would have changed because the East during that time was tougher. And there's also the Blazers and Spurs in 1990. Terry Porter had 36 points, and, you know, it ended with a Rod Strickland with a two-handed behind the back pass that Sean Elliott did not catch, and led to the Spurs or led to the Blazers, excuse me, winning that that game. That season was the Spurs had a 35 improved their record by 35 games.
Kind of set the stage for the next god. I mean, what would that be? The next what are we at now of the Spurs being a pretty damn good team outside of, you know, one little blip here and there?
Yeah, right.
I mean, this is basically, I mean, they weren't like super contenders at this right. point, but this was basically the changing of the guard of, hey, Robinson's a really good player and this is, you know, a decent team till, yeah, God, you only have that 97-98 or rather the 96-97 year.
Yeah.
Is really the only other one that hasn't been pretty okay in the last, like, what are we at now? What's that, 1990?
Yeah, that's 26 God, years.
Yeah.
So
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, I bet they've won close to 50 games every other season, you know, since then, which is, yeah, pretty amazing.
Let me see here real quick. I'm gonna look, because I never really thought of it in that, like, kind of context of, because you forget that they just so easily transition from, like, one superstar to the next. It's really not fair.
It is not fair.
Let's see here. Since, so that was 56, and they won 55, 47, 49, 55, 62, 59. The aforementioned, the 96, 97, where they won 20. Then it was 56, 37, but that was the lockout shortened year.
Yeah.
53, 58, 58, 60, 57, 59, 63, 58, 56, 54, 50, 51, 61, 50, 58, 50. 62, 55. So yeah. Life is not fair.
Other than that 97, the worst winning percentage they had is 573.
Yeah, 40, that's
47 wins. Yeah,
that doesn't seem fair. I don't like that.
I had forgotten that it went that far back. You know,
I don't like that. So. That's not nice. That's really not nice. That's not very thoughtful, San Antonio.
And then a couple of Sonics Rockets games in 93. The Sonics winning that series and. With a Sam Perkins fadeaway jumper to win in overtime. And then in 97, the Houston earning it back. Clyde Drexler had two free throws in the final 20 seconds. This was the first season the Rockets had Barkley, and then the last year before Kemp was traded by the Sonics.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Knicks and Heat, they had three playoff series in a row. Lots of ugly basketball there. Lots of
combined points of 200 points.
Yeah, this was 83-82. Right, exactly. The Wolves and Kings in 2004. It's kind of forgotten, but the this was kind of like the end of the Kings line as, you know, like an elite team. And Kevin Garnett in that game had 32 points, 21 rebounds. The Jazz and Rockets in 2007, Darren Williams at 20-14, Boozer at 35-14, and then T-Mac had 29-5-13, and Yao at 29-6. So, you know, kind of both those teams, I think, sort of kind of had, you felt like at certain different times in the late 2000s, each of those teams had a chance to sort of be a contender, and it didn't really happen for either one for various reasons, but it's kind of a nice little, what could have been kind of thing.
Yeah, and people forget that. I mean, we see the Darren Williams now and stuff. I mean, this is a guy who was a legit, I would say, a legit bona fide star at that point. I mean, this is, you look at this series, you look at other series, you just look at his career, and that it's that, like, you know, like you said, that 2007 to maybe like a 2009 is, you look at a guy who was right up. I mean, it was like Chris Paul, Darren Williams. It was like 1-1, you know, like,
well,
legit had argument. I agree. I would always have taken Chris Paul and always that. I did. But there were people making that argument, and it wasn't like, if you said that now, people would have you burned at the stake. But, you know, then it wasn't, it was silly, but it wasn't ridiculous.
For like a half a season, or so. Yeah, it wasn't ridiculous. I would have always taken Paul, but you're right.
Exactly. I'm right with you, but I always, not that I predicted this would happen with Darren Williams, but I always always thought Paul was the better player, but no, it was legit that he was a good point guard, really, really top tier point guard. Now it's just Darren Williams. Yeah. He's just kind of there.
Yeah. And Yao before the injuries, you know, and McGrady, you know, he was battling the injuries, but when he could deliver, he certainly still did. So, and the last one was of 2014, last year, the Nets versus Raptors, Pierce hitting the game winner, an extremely loud Air Canada Center, and, you know, all the antics of, you know, Toronto and the Nets that are sort of being repeated this year with the Raptors and Wizards. More Paul Pierce against Canada, I guess, than anything. That's the biggest thing. So, those are the ones that we those are our runners up, so to speak.
Didn't quite make the cut,
yeah,
but good job on that.
Right.
So thank you for coming and thank you for playing.
Thank you for performing. So so the first selection is from 1981. It is the Rockets versus the Spurs. The Rockets won 105-100. Calvin Murphy, was the standout of this game. He had 42 points on 19 field goal attempts. You know, there's a highlight package that's pretty grainy, but it shows, you know, basically his performance in the entire game. And it's interesting because it was very much like he just made a lot of jumpers, a few drives to the basket, but, you know, none of this, like, you know, fancy finishes, you know, going in at the rim kind of stuff. I mean, it's mostly like, it's very simple, but obviously it worked really well. And Murphy was, you know, he was 5'10". He was a smaller guy, but, you know, he really, at least production wise, was, you know, a rather good player for, you know, a decent chunk of time.
Yeah, I watched the highlight a little bit earlier. And yeah, as you said, there's nothing. It's like it's a really dominating performance, but a lot of it is just him like kind of going baseline and going around a screen and just like grabbing it and shooting and like just taking a lot of shots and making a lot of them. And that's really what did it. It wasn't really like, if you watch it, and again, it's with, you know, the context of watching a highlight versus that, but it's not a very, like, as you said, it's not like he's dunking over 10 guy, you know, it's not like he's doing an insane, like, just absolute domination with, we'll see sometimes these games where we watch the highlights and it's just like, you know, one or two guys really standing out, him and just making some shots. That's it. Just kind of run of the mill game for him. And interesting story too, because yeah, he wasn't probably not the most likely guy to have a dominating game.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of a heat check guy. So I mean, he occasionally have the scoring spurts, but yeah, this is definitely I think the most notable performance of his career. Yeah, and this was the year that, you know, the Rockets were 40-42. They were the sixth seed, but they had upset the Lakers in the first round of a 3-game series. They would end up making the finals this year. And, you know, arguably this, the Spurs were a slightly lesser team this season, but, you know, it was a 7-game series. So arguably this was a more impressive upset than the Lakers series. Because, I think 3 games, you know, is kind of fluky, but 7 games, you know, you really have to, you know, perform outwards. It's interesting that Calvin Murphy's last points in the game were with 6 minutes left to play.
and then they just got away from him.
Well,
we're going to try to move the ball somewhere else.
He was really tired. They mentioned the fatigue. He played like, you know, his season high in limits, because he actually came off the bench for most of the series.
Right. And that's why I kind of mentioned that he was an interesting case to have, you know, a 40 plus point game. So,
right. So, Moses Malone, hey, he had 21 points in the game, but he was battling the flu. So impressive performance with him. The Rockets won. This game 7 was won on the road. They actually won 3 out of the 4 games in San Antonio. The largest lead of the game was Houston up 97-90. Then San Antonio, Gervin helped them kind of come back. And eventually the Rockets just, you know, won at the free throw line. And this isn't necessarily a game that had a whole lot of drama, but I think the circumstances of, you know, Murphy's performance, the Rockets just being the huge underdog and being able, you know, to perform well in this game. And I just sort of the interesting blip here, I thought, made it worthy of inclusion on this list.
Absolutely. And you know, being coached by Del Harris too, which is pretty interesting. It was pretty fun. And then the fact that what I always thought was pretty cool about this particular team in this particular, you know, maybe series or whatever, is that, you know, they go to 7 games with the Spurs. And then the next round, you know, these are still the as you mentioned, the 40-42 Rockets. They dominate the Kansas City Kings. They win 4-1 and then go to the NBA Finals and then take 2 away from the Celtics as well, which
that's
is
right.
Just, I mean, this is not like it's like you said, the 3-game, okay, anything could kind of happen in 3 games. You can get 2 lucky, whatever. But then to go 7 games, then you're like, okay, well, now they're at their, you know, they've peaked. There's no way they can do any better. And then they go and just dominate the next round and then have a pretty good performance in the finals,
too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Didn't get, like, swept or anything. So it's a very interesting year. It's kind of funny how, you know, 40-42 can, how that can, you know. And what I think is kind of funny, and we'll get to that in a little bit, is, you know, this sort of thing, I don't know if it could happen anymore just because the flukiness of that first round. We're now going 7 games in the first round, you pretty much, other than a few times every so often, pretty much the best team is always going to win. Or not necessarily the best team, but the team you kind of assume. Whereas this, you know, in 3 games, you can get kind of fluky. I kind of like that idea sometimes. I don't want 1-game playoffs or anything like that. I think that's insane, but it's kind of fun to have. Even the 5 games, I didn't mind, because you can kind of get a few, you know, cheap wins in there or whatever. But then again, in the NBA, I do enjoy just watching the best teams, you know, battle for the championship and not necessarily, you know, a fluky storyline or whatever. But either way,
that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I mean, I admit there's some excitement about it, but I do sort of like the fact that they're all seven games, that, you know, you really, really have to earn it to win the title, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then what's cool too, is that if you do get one of those upsets, I feel like it does mean a lot. It means like, it's versus where, you know, right now we're talking about the fluke of the Houston Rockets, even though, hey, if in a seven game series, they might've still won, but because they only won it in three, we kind of assume it as being, you know, kind of fluky or whatever. So it's, yeah, I'm sort of on the fence. I see the reason why you would want it to sort of be, you know, some underdogs have some chances. But again, I don't really care. I just like seeing the best players and the best teams fight for the championship. I don't need I don't need like Butler in the national title game or whatever. I can survive without that. So yeah.
Different game. So, the next one is the miracle of Richfield, the Cavs and the Bullets in 1976, the Cavs winning, 87-85 on a Dick Snyder dribble drive past one Wes Unseld, hitting a winning shot over, Phil Chenier. The highlight itself is not particularly impressive, but, just the, you know, this was the first time the Cavs were in the playoffs. They'd only been playing for, I think, six seasons. And, you know, they were kind of like, you know, they didn't have any all-stars on their team that season. They didn't really have, you know, like big names. They'd actually, you know, they were a good.
A lot of gyms. They had like three gyms, I think, or three or four gyms.
Yes. I mean, they had Jim Clemens, Jim Brewer, and Jim Jones, who was probably their best player. Campy Russell, Bingo Smith, Nate Thurman, but he was at the end of his career. Austin Carr and Fitz Walker were there as well. Good old Fitz Walker. And they just had kind of come together. A lot of the guys had Ohio ties, like Jim Clemens and Luke Witt had played at Ohio State. Nate Thurman was from Akron. Campy Russell and Dick Snyder had played high school ball in Canton. So, you know, it was just sort of like the reputation was they were kind of like this blue collar team that, took the city by storm, so to speak. So, then that the Cavs were actually able to the Bullets were able to try to get a last second shot, but it missed. And then it's just crazy how the fans like rush the court and you tear down the baskets. And it's just like one of obviously you don't see that anymore and for good reason, but it is sort of like just exciting to see. The Bullets had been the champs of the East the previous season, and they had Elvin Hayes, Wes Unseld, Chenier, who was a three-time All-Star. They'd actually added Dave Bing in the offseason, so in theory they were better, but they were not as good of a regular season team and fell off here. And then the Cavs ended up playing the Celtics in the conference finals, but Jim Jones, who was their center, he broke his foot 2 days before the finals began, which basically, like, you know, obviously ended their chances, and Boston ended up winning the title. Mm-hmm. Interesting to wonder if they could have, you know, beaten Boston in that series. But what a, you know, terrible break. And you know, the of course, you know, the Cavs really, other than this is pretty much a blip in like a, you know, a really bad first 20 years or so before, you know, the Mark Price days, and you know, now they're sitting pretty, of course, with LeBron, but it just sort of, this is, I guess, it's an exciting play, and it's sort of a, you know, it's Cleveland basketball lore, and I think it sort of has enough of that local character that I think it makes it sort of a interesting addition to our list.
Yeah, absolutely. Next one on the list is the 76ers Raptors from 2001. And this is the famous Vince Carter pump fake miss shot game. And it's also famous for a bunch of other reasons as well. Of course, the morning of, and this was a big controversial point for Vince Carter and kind of his career in Toronto, is the morning of this game, Carter attended his graduation ceremony at North Carolina. He had never officially graduated and never, you know, took a few more classes and then was ready to kind of graduate and get his degree. Some people saw this, you know, in a negative light. Some people saw it in a positive light. A lot of people did it in hindsight after, you know, he missed the shot, then it was, oh, well, he wasn't focused or, you know, stuff like that. And it's kind of interesting in that, but yeah, it's kind of interesting circumstances. So the morning of, he goes to Chapel Hill. He ducks out before the commencement address was over, and he was back in Philadelphia for the Raptors 12:30 meeting. So he didn't miss anything. He ate with the team. He took his afternoon nap. He did everything that he would normally do on a game day. He just in that morning woke up early and kind of went to Chapel Hill and did something he really thought was important. And I have some quotes later on where he talks about how important that was to him to get his degree. And he always mentioned to his mother, you know, that was a big deal for her. And he felt good doing that. And that's something he personally chose to do. But of course, that would be a point of contention later in his career or, you know, later in this night. The famous thing of this is, you know, he missed a shot with 2 seconds left. It wasn't really a gimme shot if you watch it. He went for a pump fake. He got the guy up in the air. I forgot who it was. I think it was Jermaine Jones.
It was Tyrone Hill, I think.
It was Tyrone Hill, okay, which is impressive because Tyrone Hill's a big guy. So it was actually a really good call by the Sixers to put Tyrone Hill on him. It was a really good call to get Carter open. It was a really good call for him to pump fake because he had it. And then he pretty much had a relatively good look at it. 18-footer, it bounced off the back of the rim. And then I found one quote where it was kind of interesting, and this was immediately following the game. And I don't know who said it. It was kind of an anonymous quote, but it said, it made you wonder how much he wanted it. Which is interesting because Vince Carter had a pretty good game. He was 6 of 18 from the floor for 20 points, 9 assists, and 7 rebounds to go with 3 steals. So, you know, we kind of hyper-react to, like, that one shot and how he wasn't but, I mean, he had a pretty decent game without that. And if you watch the highlights, too, it's like he's very clearly, the Raptors' best player. A few other guys, you have Antonio Davis, who had a great game, 23 points, 9 rebounds. And then two of the other Toronto starters really didn't do much. Evan Williams and Morris Peterson, they didn't reach double figures. You had Charles Oakley on this team. You had a few. They weren't very deep. And the Sixers weren't, you know, much deeper on their own. But a lot of the team, it was Vince Carter's team for a lot. You know, a lot. They don't get to that game without Vince Carter. So it's kind of funny now that people kind of hyperreact. A few other quotes about that last shot. And I'm focusing on that because that was really, I think, the prevailing moment from this. It's Lenny Wilkins, who was the head coach of the Raptors at the time. He said, when we got into the huddle, getting ready for that last shot. This is from Carter. Carter said that when we got in the huddle, he said, I coach, I want the ball. And said, you know, I had everything ready. I pump fake, swing through. But halfway through, it looked good and ended up hitting the back of the rim. So Carter, you know, says, coach, give me the ball. I want to do it. It feels like he's got a good shot. And of course, it doesn't go through. It doesn't go in. And it kind of changed a lot of what would happen in the history of, you know, Vince Carter. And, you know, a few years later, he'd be out of Toronto. It's still kind of I think they've kind of gotten over it, but for a while really vilified by the Toronto fan base for kind of giving up on the team, which he did in a sense. You know, his last few years there were not good. And he was sulking and wanted to be traded and a bunch of other, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, this really was kind of the end of the honeymoon in a lot of ways for Vince Carter and, you know, Toronto Raptors. But not taking away anything from the 76ers is a big game for them as well. Of course, they went to the finals this year on the back of Allen Iverson. Iverson had 21 points in here, but I think the most important part of this game for Iverson, and if you watch the highlights, it's pretty interesting as well, is that he had 16 assists. And when you watch that and you think of, you know, Allen Iverson having 16 assists, Toronto, smartly enough, and that absolutely would be the strategy I would do too, put like 2 or 3 guys on Iverson every time he drove the ball. Every time he touched the ball, somebody abandoned their guy to go on to Iverson, which, to be honest, I probably would have done the same thing as well. But it led to a lot of good games for a few guys. Aaron McKee had 22 points. And then the shocking, Jermaine Jones had what Doug Collins called his breakout game during this game. It was pretty great. He goes, this is the breakout game of Jermaine Jones. I was like, maybe not. But he had 16 points on 6-9 shooting, so he had a really good game as well. And, of course, this is the year that they the Sixers had Dikembe Mutombo. He had 10 points and 17 rebounds to lead them. And then either team that got through, I thought it would have been a big deal for either one, because this is a big deal for the Sixers as well to kind of get there and defeat Toronto and get into that next round, because they felt they had a great team and Allen Iverson was probably at his peak at this year, and it just kind of all worked out. You know, he won the MVP that year and all the good stuff. But yeah, this is kind of the famous game for that last shot, and then a lot of, you know, what went into the last shot and a lot of what happened with Vince Carter, you know, afterwards. And what were your kind of thoughts on his going to the graduation? Do you see that as a not focused thing or something that is kind of okay?
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think it's silly to, I guess in retrospect,
if he hits that shot, nobody cares.
Well, absolutely not. And I guess in retrospect, because like there was other stuff that led you to like doubt like his commitment to Toronto, mm-hmm. and to playing and all that. I mean, basically he admitted to basically dogging it to get traded. So it sort of fits in with that, you know, with later behavior. But without that, yeah, I think going to your college graduation is pretty important. And obviously it's impossible to know whether it would have made any difference. But I think it's silly criticism.
Yeah, I agree. And then, yeah, of course, this is, as I mentioned, the Sixers would, you know, beat the Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals and go to the NBA Finals, where they would lose to the Los Angeles Lakers. And Toronto would, you know, they'd have a few decent years after that. But then it would, like I said, the bloom was kind of off the rose. And a few years later, you know, Vince Carter was gone and they went through their kind of relative down period, you know, with Chris Bosh and Andre Bargnani or whatever. And they're finally gotten out of it now. And they're a consistently pretty good team and, you know, a consistent playoff team. But a lot of ill will towards Vince Carter kind of after this. This was a big point in the changing of the guard, where he could really almost do no wrong. And then it sort of, it became, hey, you know, are we going to be a title team with this guy as our best player? And you know, ended up not being the case. But yeah, this is, I don't know if you watched the highlights of this, but it's a really fun game to sort of watch. And one thing that, and I've mentioned it before on the podcast, early 2000s basketball, man, is ugly. It's like so bad. Like guys just, and it might be we're kind of spoiled now and the game is so fluid and crisp now. And it's almost to an extent kind of boring now because everybody's kind of really good at what they do and really good at like spacing and the coaching's really good. But this is just like a shit, like guys are bumping into each other. Nobody cares about a possession. They're just like chucking the ball over the place. They're all fighting over long twos. They're like bumping into each other to take an 18 footer. And it's just like, you forget like how, you know, how coach and how crisp and all that stuff today's game is when you watch now and you take for granted, you know, this floor spacing and all that sort of stuff where Vince Carter has no room this entire game because the Toronto Raptors have no 3-point shooters, like literally zero guys that can shoot a three. So it was so bad. Like,
although in fairness, you know, I've been watching a decent amount of Milwaukee, Chicago and Washington, Toronto this year. And
that's, I was going to say Washington, Toronto is a nice little throwback to the days of nobody being able to shoot threes. So.
Yeah. Bulls can shoot threes at least. Milwaukee would fit in.
Milwaukee would be a great, they probably, this Milwaukee team would probably win the 2001
probably
Eastern Conference because Giannis and Michael Carter Williams bumping into each other not knowing where to go. It's a pretty interesting dynamic there that Milwaukee has, but it was kind of fun to watch though because I have vivid memories of this game and I remember being really disappointed when you know Vince Carter missed that shot and I was like, hey, it'll be okay, he'll come back next year, and not really, but either way. All right, next one on our list is the Boston Celtics-Cleveland Cavaliers. This is from 2008, and this is a really, really fun game.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry.
We skipped one.
I see it now. Sorry, I was scrolling up too much. Never mind. False alarm. You got a hint. This is the order. Never mind. We're going to the Indiana Pacers-New York Knicks from 1995. 97-95, Pacers victory. This one is famous. This series is famous probably for, of course, the Reggie Miller comeback. The infamous 8 points in 11 seconds. And then the year before had the Reggie comeback while sniping at Spike Lee. So you have a lot of interesting stuff there.
This was the third series in a row between the teams, I believe.
Right.
So.
And this is when they were just huge rivals on the backs of those series. I mean, these guys were always in either the Eastern Conference Finals or the Eastern Conference Semis. It always seemed like a matchup would come on between these two, and they would always be really good games, really close matchups, and a lot of bad blood between, you know, Reggie Miller, Spike Lee, Patrick Ewing, the whole Knicks culture at that time, the whole Indiana culture, the, you know, small town Pacers versus the big town Knicks. I mean, it had everything you would want out of a storyline of like two teams. I mean, they're two completely different teams and just a lot of really fun stuff. I have vivid memories and good memories of, you know, these rivalries or whatever. But this one is famous. The Pacers finally vanquished the New York Knicks. So much so the Indiana Pacers announcer, I don't know if you watched that highlight video, was insane when they won. Yes. He said, "We're going to Disneyland. Ding dong, the witch is dead." And I was like, oh, "Okay, guys. Like, there's a lot of playoffs to be played. Like, you would think they just won the NBA final. Like, honestly, and I'm not one of those guys. It's like, oh, you have to contain your excitement. But this guy was very excited that they beat the Knicks. And I get it. Yeah. But like, it was exciting.
It had been
like
very disappointing in the previous year for them to when they lost to the Knicks in the Eastern Conference Finals the previous year. And it was, you know, it was very close. Like, and it was." You know, they could have won it in I think they could have won it in game six at home, and then they failed to do so and they lost it in game seven in New York, one of those things. So,
and of course, Winning Time, the 30 for 30 documentary, you know, talks about all these things.
It's very good.
Great documentary. Yeah. As well, if you haven't already seen it, which I think everybody in the world probably has. So I don't know why I'm telling you, because you probably did.
Well,
anyway, maybe not. But if you haven't, please go
it's
watch
on
it
on Netflix.
Right now. Yes. Oh, yes. All those 30. I they putting the new ones up there too. I saw the other day. I was like browsing, and the Christian Laettner one was already up there.
Yeah. It's
added nice. To the list.
Yeah.
Is that one any good? I haven't watched that one yet.
I watched a bit of it. It was okay. I kind of got a little bored, but I think I fell asleep, and then I never really went back to it. I mean, if you're really into college basketball, which I know you are not, and I'm not, but somebody who theoretically might be listening, it's pretty interesting, and it kind of gets into the persona and some of the Duke. like the myth versus the reality of him and sort of that, you know, Duke. But yeah, I didn't love her or anything.
So there's not an extensive breakdown of his NBA career.
Maybe they get to that, but
I don't know what you're talking about. But yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what I'm holding out hope for. But right. Yeah. Probably shouldn't do that. So this game as well is famous for the Ewing layup that bounces off the back of the rim. And, right. And you know, a few good quotes, you know, about this. Derek Harper mentioned, it was like the seas opened up. When I saw him go up, I was thinking overtime and we would have won it in overtime. So Derek Harper says, screw overtime. I don't care. We don't have to play. We're going to win in overtime. But unfortunately, it did not. And then Ewing, who kind of to this day still says, hey, I got a good play. And it really is. He's wide open. Like, there's no reason he should have missed that, really. And, like, you know, it's one of those shots where if he was in a gym, he'd probably make it 98 out of 100 times or something like that. But just in this case, yeah. You know, bounced off the rim. He said, I thought I made a great play getting to the hole. I thought it went in. I thought I had it tied up. To see it come back out is so disappointing. I was stunned. I can't remember anything like this before.
Yeah, he had a calf injury, so he couldn't quite get up as high as he normally would have. He mm-hmm. probably could have dunked it, you know, in normal circumstances. But so that, you know, was obviously made a difference there. But I mean, this is really a an exciting dude. And these teams were like really like deep teams, you know, like
they were.
I mean, you know, the Pacers had, I mean, they had Rick Smits, obviously, Derek McKee, the Davises, and then Mark Jackson was I think this was his first year on the Pacers. Haywood Workman, Sam Mitchell, Byron Scott, you know, like, I mean, these teams just had like a lot of you know, pretty strong players. The Knicks as well, you know, obviously they have Ewing, Starks, and Oakley and Mason and Harper, who had been brought on a couple, I think a year or two before, and, you know, Charles Smith. I mean, these both.
Greg Anthony, yeah. You know, they had a lot of really.
Doug Christie played 2 minutes in this series.
Oh, did he? I forgot about the Doug Christie Knicks.
Yeah, there you go. So, good times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is, as you mentioned, classic, you know, deep mid-90s Pacers as well. All five starters were in double figures. Reggie Miller had 29 points. Rick Smits had 19. And interestingly enough, Rick Smits took only one less shot than Reggie Miller. He took 17. Reggie Miller took 18. So this was a feed the ball to Rick Smits type game.
Gotta feed the post.
And this, I believe this was his career year, too. I think he had something like 17 points and 9 rebounds this year. Like, this was a really, really good year for Rick Smits, which kind of, we always kind of forget that he, you know, he had a period where he was a pretty damn good player. I mean, we kind of, I feel like he kind of gets laughed at a lot. I don't know if it's just because he's a tall, goofy kind of white guy, but I don't know. Rick Smits is a damn good player, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was fine. He actually, let's see. Yeah, he was 17 and
that was this year, correct?
Yeah, he was 17 in 7. He wasn't really a very good rebounder for his size, I guess.
No, he was not very good.
Next year he was 18 and 7. So yeah, I mean, he was basically close to the peak of his career. I mean, he was always like around 15, 16, 17 point scorer and, you know, about 6-7 rebounds. So he should play around 30 minutes or so. So I mean, that's, you know, solid production.
Absolutely. A few other things here. You know, Ewing, despite the late miss, where everybody kind of remembers him for that miss, otherwise he was great. 29 points, 14 rebounds, just had a really, really good game. And of course, that last shot, which, you know, if he made it, this would have been, you know, one of the games that we'd remember of, you know, a dominant Patrick Ewing or whatever. You know, a few other things. Four of the five Knicks starters, again, as you mentioned, the depth of these two teams, four of the five Knicks starters had double digits. And Charles Oakley was the only one of those to not have double digit points. He had 9. So can't really take it away from him too much. And then this is another interesting thing, is this was the end of the Knicks, somewhat as we know it, of the mid-90s Knicks, because the day after Pat Riley resigned immediately following this game via fax to take a job with the Miami Heat. And, you know, if there's one thing Pat Riley stands for, it's, you know,
it's integrity.
It's integrity. I mean, you don't sit there and smile when you have hidden agendas, yeah. Pat Riley.
Right. You don't do that.
He doesn't do that.
Yeah.
What he does is he quits the day after via to a team that apparently he didn't talk to prior to this game whatsoever. He just decided immediately following this game, I am going to call the Miami Heat and see if they would like me to be their head coach.
Makes sense.
Like, they did not talk beforehand, because that would be ridiculous. Yeah. So you don't build a team that way either. You don't like have a secret meeting with a guy when he's still a member of another team.
No, that would be tampering.
That's not what Pat Riley does.
That would be tampering.
Right.
You definitely don't do that.
And Pat Riley doesn't tamper. Yeah. God damn it. Can't tell where we're throwing shade at Pat Riley in his comments earlier this week.
Maybe.
So maybe we're not. I don't want to say we're explicitly doing that. We might be. So we're maybe possibly beating around the bush. I don't know. Either way, yeah. So Pat Riley, resigned. Reggie Miller, super happy about this win. And the Pacers, as mentioned, you know, the ding dong, the witch is dead. This was like, you know, slaying the monster of the New York Knicks. He said, this is the biggest hurdle for us. Finally getting past the Knicks. We're not overlooking Orlando because they would obviously go on to face Orlando. We're all banged up. And they've been resting for 4 or 5 days. That's going to be tough, but we're there, and that's the most important thing right now. So to Reggie Miller, this was kind of the NBA Finals for them and the Indiana Pacers because, yeah, of course, they would not defeat the Orlando Magic. But still a real interesting, you know, it was nice to see them finally do it because it was sort of, and especially if you watch that winning time, you see the huge disappointment in Indiana. Had they never won this game and never beaten the Knicks in a series, it really would have changed the whole, I think, a lot of what the Pacers were and the whole dynamic of Reggie Miller and all that sort of stuff. Because you know what I mean? Like, it's then they're just kind of a pesky little team that loses all the time.
Yeah. And it's kind of...
We're here, they...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to say, here they kind of legitimize themselves. It's like, okay, you know what? They are a really... And it shouldn't have been that way because, you know, they went to Eastern Conference Finals, and I don't know if it was that way. But I sort of kind of get that idea is, you know, if you can never really... Them beating the Knicks was a big, big, big deal for them to become... You know, one of those teams, or one of the big time teams in the league. So
yeah, it's interesting. You know, I had kind of forgotten, but that the Knicks and Pacers had the '99 and 2000 series as well. You know, those were kind of different. Those were, you know, different teams. I mean, they had Reggie Miller. The Pacers were very different. They had Rick Smits and Reggie Miller pretty much. The rest of the contributors were gone. The Knicks, you know, they had Ewing for the first series. I think he was traded. In 2000. So, you know, they kind of revamped pretty much. But it's interesting. They were actually pretty good. You know, they both kind of had a couple of. They dipped down for, you know, a season or two in the late 2000s, but then or in the late 90s, and then they were pretty strong there in like, you know, 99, 2000. So I kind of forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Anything more on that game?
I don't believe so.
Okay, cool. So I'll move on now to the one that I mentioned before, the Boston Celtics Cleveland Cavaliers from 2008. And this one is famous for a lot of reasons. And this is, you know, I'll kind of get into the history of the two franchises. This is, of course, the first year of the big three of the Celtics of, you know, Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett coming together. And this game was all Pierce versus LeBron. And this was LeBron taking a not so good Cleveland Cavaliers team to the limit. I mean, really doing, I think, all he could do with that team. And this is the famous, you know, they had Zildjian Ilgauskas, but in this particular game, Delonte West was the second highest scorer for the Cavaliers, and that's probably not a good thing if that's the case. You know, Zildjian Ilgauskas, I mentioned, Ben Wallace, Wally Szczerbiak, but really not a very deep team. You know, he had guys like, you know, Damon Jones and Joe Smith and those sort of guys, but it wasn't a great team by any means.
Although it was actually a significantly better team than the previous year's team that actually made the
Drew
finals.
Team.
I mean, they made a pretty savvy trade to get Ben Wallace and Delonte West and Wally Szczerbiak. Yeah, those guys actually did help quite a bit, and then later they you know, were able to get Mo Williams and you know, put together actually a pretty elite team, because they actually, if I recall correctly, they actually really struggled early in this 08 season, and they made the trade, and they were significantly better. You know, they were the two teams were closer than you would think based on the records.
Right. And then they would, you know, the next year they would win, what, 60, a lot.
55, 60, something like that.
Or 65, somewhere. Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was 63 or 65. But yeah, this was kind of the halfway mark here is when they really kind of turned it on. And then they would become, you know, what we would kind of know as the dominant sort of LeBron. Couldn't ever, you know, win the NBA Finals. But, you know, this was the last year of what I would consider the truly, you know, quote, bad Cavaliers teams that LeBron really put on his back and really did a lot with. But as I mentioned, this was all Paul Pierce and LeBron James. And this a lot of ways, and if a lot of the articles as well mentioned, this was very much it felt like a Larry Bird versus Dominic Wilkins type thing, where they were just going, you know, Boston Celtic going, you know, shot for shot with, you know, LeBron James, Cleveland, you know, obviously not in the Atlanta Hawk, but, you know, going shot for shot with those guys. It felt very much like that, where it was, and especially in the highlights, you get that too. It was like, okay, your turn, my turn. And then it was fun that way. Kevin Garnett mentions that the plan before the game, and this is his quote, you know, the plan for game 7 was to get the ball to Paul Pierce and get the hell out of the way. And interestingly enough, the tone was set very quickly because Pierce stole the ball from LeBron James in the opening possession and set the tone for the game in a lot of ways of just saying, okay, you know, I'm this is my game and give me the ball. And as Garnett said, just get the hell out of the way. And it was perfect. You know, LeBron James, you know, not discrediting what he did. Because, you know, obviously the Celtics won this game, but not discrediting what LeBron did. He had 45 points, 6 assists, 5 rebounds, 48% shooting. He was only 3 of 11 from 3, though, so he hadn't quite gotten, you know, efficient at that yet. That would be a few years before he would really become a pretty solid 3-point shooter. Not that he's ever been, you know, great, but at least a little bit better than this. Interestingly enough, though, he got to the line 19 times and made 14. So he was really, this was the peak slashing LeBron years, where he was just so good at getting to the rim and getting fouls and going to the line. The rest of the Cavaliers, I mentioned, there's not much to show up, and they definitely did not. Delonte West was the second best scorer with 15. Big Z, he went 2 of 8, and the rest of the team was just, as I mentioned, not very good, not really good scorers. You know, guys like, you know, Ben Wallace, and at this point, Wally Szczerbiak was really past his point. And, you know, Ben Wallace was never a scorer, so you weren't going to get that out of him. So there was not a lot of help here for LeBron, and he kind of had to do it on his own. And the fact that he was able to get them to 7 games and really get them, you know, to the limit. And it would have been interesting if he had sort of knocked out that big three before it ever really got started. You know that?
Yeah.
I cannot imagine what would have been written about Paul Pierce, Ray Allen, and Kevin Garnett if LeBron and that team, you know, knocked them out of this round. But
yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot that changes with that. I mean, you know, if they manage to, you know, even if they lose the next round of the Pistons, or if they get to the finals, we get a Kobe LeBron finals. I think there's less urgency maybe in 2009 and in 2010 with those playoff disappointments to keep panicking and adding guys. Like, maybe they feel like LeBron has a little bit more confidence in the plan if 2008 goes better. You know, if the Pistons go to the finals this year, maybe they don't trade Chauncey Billups. Maybe their window extends another year or two. Because the Pistons were really good that year too. I mean, there's so much that, a lot of our thinking on a lot of people might change a lot with, you know, a different result this game.
Certainly. Absolutely. And the Celtics, of course, is led by Paul Pierce, who had one of the games of his life, 41 points on, you know, a little over 56% shooting, 5 assists, 2 steals, 4 rebounds. Really good game from 3 as well, 4 from 6 from 3. Ray Allen, believe it or not, did not do well. He went 1 of 6 from the field, 0 of 2 from 3. Can you imagine a game where Ray Allen takes 2 threes and goes, I'm done. Like, that's it for me. Don't pass me the ball anymore, guys. I'm done. And that's what I mean. If the Celtics lose this, can you imagine, like, Ray? I mean, that just a nothing game, right, from Ray Allen. Garnett did okay, but Ray Allen really just kind of struggled. And a surprising contribution as well. And when you watch the highlights, it's a shocking thing to everybody in the crowd and to the announcers and to the Celtics bench that P.J. Brown dropped 10 points and 6 rebounds in only 20 minutes and had a really good defensive play at the end of the game. LeBron, you know, with 30 seconds left, of course, he has the ball in his hands, gets really close to the hole, has a pretty good play, passes it up, and then kind of tries to go baseline, where he's met by P.J. Brown, who doesn't block the shot, but kind of sets it off stride. And then LeBron kind of misses it. And you know, Paul Pierce goes to the line, gets the rebound, goes to the line, sinks a pair of free throws and, you know, kind of sets the game. Gives the Celtics, you know, the advantage there. And that was the game. That was it. And, you know, it's interesting enough, you know, we mentioned about all the differences. You know, LeBron hits that shot. You know, that changes a lot of stuff. PJ Brown, I mean, it's crazy. That's what's so great about game sevens, that, like, you look at, if PJ Brown doesn't, like, you know, step up in defense or rotate over and LeBron gets an easy shot, like, how does that change how Ray Allen is considered historically? You know what I mean? Like, that's what's so cool about game sevens,
right? Yeah,
is the way we look at it. It's like just a stupid little silly thing like that. And, you know, Ray Allen is fine. And, you know, the big three is this great triumphant thing that goes on to win the NBA finals. And these players have a legacy and they have their rings and all. It's just, yeah, I love it. Yeah. It's why this is so fun, doing the game seven stuff. As far as this game, you know, Dr. Jack Ramsey after the game said, you know, this was the game. This is the one that elevated Pierce to the next level. It's what made him a superstar. I don't know about that, but. Because I think he was already before.
Yeah.
I don't think this really was like, oh, okay. But
maybe people see it now, you know, where they didn't see it before.
Right. And there was questions, too. People forget, in the early 2000s, there was a lot of questions about what Paul Pierce, you know, what his motivations were, how good of a leader he was, all that sort of stuff. You know, then Antoine Walker career, you know, him and Antoine, it wasn't a good thing.
Right. I mean, it was kind of the same, some of the same stuff as Vince Carter.
Right, exactly.
Pierce, you know, managed to overcome that reputation as a star, and Carter eventually did, but more as a role player.
Yeah, Exactly. And as LeBron after the game said, you know, I love going against the best, and Paul Pierce is one of those guys. So LeBron kind of putting Paul Pierce over. And as mentioned, the Celtics went on to defeat the Detroit Pistons in the Eastern Finals and then defeat the Los Angeles Lakers in the NBA Finals. The Cavaliers went on to win 66 games the next year and then lose in the Eastern Finals. The year after, they won 61 but lost in the semis. And that would be LeBron's last year. Yes, to the Celtics, who then vanquished the LeBron Cavaliers. And I don't know what happened with LeBron after that, but I assume the Cavaliers went on to have a good run afterwards.
Probably,
so.
Yeah.
They acquired the pieces that they needed and went on to have a good career with LeBron at the helm. So I stopped watching basketball after that year, so I don't know what happened.
Yeah,
I'll assume all is well in Cleveland.
Sounds about right. Yeah, I would not.
Because I started watching again, and LeBron's on Cleveland, and they're in the playoffs again. So I assume all that time in between was all
during
good.
During that 4-year
so
gap,
cool.
He must. Right. Why would he leave Cleveland? That would be ridiculous.
Yeah, that, his hometown. What are you talking about? Like, where would he go?
Yeah, I don't know. So our next choice is the Bucks and the 76ers in 1986. 113-112, the Bucks actually win the series. And the reason that I picked this one is it's more kind of cumulative of the Bucks and the Sixers. I played like five series with the 76ers dating back to 81, which they had another great semifinal series that sort of, you know, began their rivalry, kind of capped off with the famous Easter Sunday game 7 in Philadelphia that the Sixers won. So this is kind of a little bit of the end of the line for that rivalry for Dr. J Sixers. He would retire in another year. Barkley was the fresh star for the Sixers. They still had Maurice Cheeks was chugging along, but obviously was getting older. Bobby Jones was, you know, nearing the end of the line. Both Andrew Toney had suffered a career-ending injury. He played a little bit, but it was never the same. Moses Malone was out for the series, so the Sixers were very thin. They actually dusted off Bob McAdoo and tried to get him on their bench, but that didn't work out so well.
Like literally dusting him off. Yeah. this is an old Bob McAdoo.
And the Bucks had kind of sort of transitioned from like the Marquez Johnson led team to Terry Cummings. Sidney Moncrief was still there. They also had Paul Pressey and Ricky Pierce and Craig Hodges of all. I had no idea he had actually played for the Bucks before, you know.
And pretty prominent role too. Yeah,
he actually hits the game winner in this game with 29 seconds left. Before that, basically the Bucks had the Sixers gone on a 14-4 run, and then it was a 1-point game for the final 3 minutes, and they're in Milwaukee. And then the Sixers have the ball with 7 seconds remaining, but Julius Erving misses 16-footer. Ricky Pierce falls on the loose ball, and then Barkley falls on top of Pierce, and that's it. So, what I found also very interesting is there's a LA Times article about it, and Sidney Moncrief says it would be difficult to erase the memory of losing four of the previous 5 years to Philadelphia, including last season's 4-game sweep. It's all in the past. All we can deal with is 1986. But I don't think people are going to forget the years prior 1986. So it's sort of interesting how, like, I don't know if the regrets or whatever, like everything, because sports like feels like so much in the moment. It's like, okay, if I get a victory in this moment, it vindicates the other ones in a way.
Right.
But that, you know, it's interesting for Moncrief to not really have that mentality here. I mean, I'm sure he was obviously happy, but you know, this was the third time in 4 years for the Bucks in the Eastern Conference Finals, and they ended up playing, of course, one of the best teams of all time, the 86 Celtics. That didn't work out so well for them in that series either. But you know, we've mentioned before, but it's always worth mentioning, the Bucks are kind of, because of just the great Sixers, the great Celtics, and later the great Pistons teams, the Bucks, and to a lesser extent the Hawks, are kind of completely forgotten as really strong Eastern Conference powers for in the Bucks case basically the whole decade, for the Hawks case more the latter part of the decade.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
it's a shame, but We haven't done that. We were going to do a podcast one of these days about the forgotten franchises or whatever, the real good, you know, forgotten franchise. I'm looking forward to that.
Kind of like the not dynasty
or the forgotten dynasties
not quite dynasty, but yeah, that sort of that idea. Yeah, I think we've definitely tossed a few variations of that around. So
I look forward to doing that because it'd be fun to. Because I think we're doing a good job of that, because I think we bring them up, the Bucks, pretty much on a day on a episode basis. But yeah, I mean it's again, we talk about circumstance, we talk about little games here and there. Like there's just a few things that could have changed, you know, if the Bucks just get to one NBA Finals, it changes a lot of stuff. Doesn't happen,
interesting thing that the Bucks swept the Celtics in 83. And then lost to the 76ers in the Eastern Conference Finals. But I think maybe sort of turned a turned some heads in, you know, the Celtics and got them, you know, a little more serious. And in Bird in particular, I think kind of was, I think they traded Rick Roby, and then the fun that Larry Bird was having started to reduce. And it was, you know, Bird was always serious and dedicated, but I think even more so after that series, supposedly, you know, from some of the reading I've done. So. But yeah, it is interesting stuff. And then, speaking of some what ifs, is we go to our number one series, and probably not a surprise for students of NBA history, but it is the Celtics and Hawks 1988, the famous back and forth duel that you alluded to before, Dominique Wilkins and Larry Bird. Wilkins, he had 47 points in all, 16th in the fourth quarter, and Bird had 34, but 20 in the fourth quarter. So, and it is just like incredible to watch both these guys. It is very much like back and forth. And
yeah, I was going to say, when you talk about back and forth, sometimes we overuse that. But this is actually like, okay, like you scored, now me. Okay. It is very much like his turn, my turn, his turn. I mean, we overuse that term for like a game where two guys are both doing well, but this is really like the personification of, you know, a back and forth.
Absolutely, yeah. And, I would argue that this is the most famous game in Atlanta Hawks history. They were down two, then they won three in a row, including game five in Boston, which was kind of the first sign. It's like, oh, wow, this team might be pretty good. There's a Peachtree Hoops post talking about the Hawks were both top four teams in SRS that season, and even though they were only playing the second round, it was a little bit like the Spurs and the Clippers this year in the first round, where like two teams that, you know, could be title contenders just happened to be matched up, you know, early on in the playoffs. And Bird was second in PER, Dominique was fifth in PER. The Hawks certainly were a really good team here. I mean, it wasn't just kind of a fluke that they took them to seven games. I mean, they really did test them. It really was. It took everything the Celtics had. You know, even though the Celtics were obviously, you know, Bird was starting to deal with the injuries, and they were not quite as strong as they were in their peak, but you know, they still had the big three. McHale delivers here with 33 and 13. Doc Rivers had 16 points, 18 assists, and Randy Whitman had 22 points for the Hawks.
Yes.
And then was promptly traded in the offseason afterward. He had a sarcastic quip for that. But basically, yeah, I mean, the, breaks down, Bird hits a three from the corner for a 7-point lead with about a minute 44 left. And then Wilkins hits a jumper from the circle, then later makes two free throws, cutting it down to 112-109 with 44 seconds left. Then, like, Bird, like, beats this definitely shows Wilkins' lack of defensive chops, because Bird just makes a pretty
– Bird's pushing blow by
him. Yeah, he actually blew by him, and then Kevin Wills was just too late to block the shot. And then but Wilkins actually missed a dunk, but was able to get a put back to get it back to three. And then there's sort of a controversial goaltending call on Doc Rivers on Danny Ainge. Doc Rivers, when he was coach of the Celtics, said that he later got Tommy Heinsohn to admit that it was not really a goaltend. You know, of course, Tommy Heinsohn being the ultimate Celtics homer. And with 1 second left, Dominique goes to the line. They're trailing by three. He makes the first, and he intentionally misses the second, and it goes to a Hawks player, but he's not able to get the shot off before the buzzer, and the Celtics win 118-116. So I think between this and the Pierce LeBron duel, it has the best video to kind of showcase, you know, like the exciting stuff that is going on here. And then the Celtics ended up losing in the conference finals to the Pistons, which ended a four final streak of them. You know, they were in four straight finals and basically, you know, never really got to that point again. And the Hawks, you know, kind of they ended up trading. They traded Tre Rollins and Randy Whitman, and they added Moses Malone and Reggie Theus, which like on paper wasn't necessarily a bad move, but it just kind of wrecked their chemistry because they had a couple of years in a row where they, you know, had mid 50 wins teams. I mean, they like if they had charted a better course, might have been able to actually, you know, be like a title contender. But although, you know, they probably weren't going to be if they won this series, they probably weren't going to be beating the Pistons in the next round. But still, I mean, I do think they had a higher ceiling that, you know, unfortunately for them was not and for me as a Hawks fan was not able to be accomplished because of the result here. But Larry Bird, man, he's hard to beat.
Yeah, he's a tough guy. And you would kind of assume adding, you know, and I get they're just, you know, adding Moses Malone and Reggie Theus, you're like, okay, let's go. Like, that's a huge upgrade. But as you mentioned, sometimes chemistry and just those guys fitting their roles works perfect. Because, that's a huge net gain just on paper. You look at those two guys and go, oh, wow, now we're ready. But,
right, but Theus was kind of like an empty scorer. And Moses was, you know, was 36 actually only 33. But he had a lot of miles on him at this point, so...
They sound better than they really were for that team, in a sense. Like, especially a guy like Theus, like you mentioned, he you look at his numbers and they're pretty gaudy, and you look at, you know, but yeah, as you said, it's empty stuff. It doesn't work in the flow of an offense and stuff. But yeah, you know, we mentioned about those game sevens. I think that's the thing that we're going to find out as we keep going on throughout this series is just how different it becomes after that. If you know, if one game is different, they don't trade those guys probably, or maybe they still do, but who knows? You know, it's just so interesting to see how one game can so much, you know, alter a team and how people can feel like they're so close to getting somewhere and then just not quite there, and how much more disappointing that can kind of become. You know, we look at the Raptors of Vince Carter. Had they lost in five games, it might not have been a big deal, but the fact that they were that close and they were just one shot away, and it adds a whole different element because it's not like okay, well, you know what, hey, they were the better team. It was like, no, we were right there. And like and the games that we picked, especially these ones, are all close games. These are all super close games that either team could have won at any point during the. And then, you look at just the franchises changing and altering so much based off that, you know, a few minutes, a few possessions, a few points, you know, one game. It's going to be fascinating and even more so as we go on. But I thought the early rounds was particularly interesting because you see a lot of teams where, you know, in the NBA Finals, you go to seven games, you lose. Yeah, okay, whatever, we got there. But this one is the early rounds and in the semis a lot of ways too is like, okay, now we have to retool because we're right there but not quite there. And you see that almost with every single team here that loses. And then, you know, the opposite with every team that wins is where a lot of times the teams that win just kind of keep going on. And a lot of times they've went on to have a pretty good, you know, dynasty or whatever, you know, they'd be consistently good. So it was pretty fun to kind of look back at these early rounds.
Yeah. It's almost like if you come that close, there's almost like a more of a pressure to change things because you feel like there's just that like, oh, if
you're
just,
one piece away,
one thing, you know, and that.
Like the Hawks were just a Moses Malone and Reggie Theus away from, okay, now we're going to, you know, and then like, every single one of those teams, you know, Toronto, you know, made big changes the next year. We talk about that. The Cavs, obviously they made, you know, big changes after that. It's just every team that we've talked about, the ones that lose always seem to do something afterwards. Like we're okay. We just one more thing and then we got it. But a lot of times it doesn't work out that way, but very interesting.
Exactly. So, all right, Rich, well, you got anything else to say about early round game sevens?
I do not. No, I'm ready to. I'm excited to see how the rest of this kind of series goes. And if you have games in either of those that we might have missed, or ones that you would like us to talk about, or you know, a certain moment or memory of any game sevens in the playoffs, let us know. We'll talk about them on the podcast. We'll retweet you all that good stuff. I think it's important because everybody sort of has a game. I mean, it's so much easier to remember a game seven. We remember series as a whole and remember moments. But I know watching back on these highlights and stuff, we just so vividly remember game seven. Because they're just so much fun to watch. Everything is on the line. Like, you know what I mean? And so you every possession, every play is like hypersensitive. So I think it's a lot easier to remember a game seven in your history that you love versus you know, a random game five that you liked. You might know a game for a certain highlight, but I feel like game sevens, you know, for being a game seven and you know certain stuff from it. So if you have one that you liked, one of your favorites, anything like that, please over and back NBA.
Yes.
I'd like to hear from you.
We're on the Twitter, as Rich mentioned. We also have Facebook, and you can find us at the podiumgame.com is our home. We also have a iTunes feed. We're part of the HB Basketball Network, the Harvard Paroxysm Basketball Network. So check us out on iTunes, and leave a love it if you left a rating and review of not just us, but of all the great podcasts that are on the feed. Did some really great stuff previewing the playoffs, and there's a lot of fun shows on there. So we're proud to be part of it, and. Did I forget anything, Rich? Is that
I think you got it. I think we're done.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, everyone, for checking us out, and we'll be back soon.